Welcome to Idle Red Hands Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
And this is our weekly compact description of what we've been doing, updates, and everything going on with Idle Red Hands, upcoming podcasts, upcoming reviews. So, yeah. Chris, what's going on?
I'm not getting a lot of sleep because we're trying to get my kid to sleep in her own bed, and yeah, that's rough. So I have plenty of time to think about RPGs at like 3 o'clock in the morning. Let's see, in terms of like game stuff, I'm still doing that April TTRPG maker hashtag. And I was kind of remiss last week to not say it was started by Kira McGran. And yeah, it's just 30 questions that you're supposed to answer one a day. And some of them are pretty hard. Like the last one was, how are the games you create decolonizing? So some of the stuff is kind of difficult to answer.
Well, that's cool.
Supposed to get you to think about stuff.
But. Right, right. Challenging stuff. Well, that's cool. I saw you posted on your Twitter. There was a kind of a zine-looking RPG. What was that?
The name of the game was In the Light of the Ghost Star. And it's like super far future. The sun is burnt out and just a white dwarf. And people travel from Mars to scavenge super future tech. Oh. So you're talking like millennia in the future. And it's just like, what, like 10 pages? 8 of which are adventure and a hex map. And like the rules are literally one page. And I just really like, or have gotten to like zine style RPGs for a couple of reasons. They look awesome. And as kind of a designer, you know, getting something to look random is not as easy as it sounds. It's really hard. And so that's really appealing. The other one is compacting stuff. The rules fit on a single page. Again, as a designer, I think that's a fun challenge. To work with such a small space, which is why I like cards as well. And lastly, it's really different from the big 300 page doorstop tomes that a lot of the bigger game companies produce. And it's just kind of nice where you almost don't care about this thing that much because you can just print out 4 other pages, staple them together, and you have a new one. So I've seen other people say that the zines were important in history and literature because of how quickly they could be produced and how quickly they could spread ideas.
Yes.
And I kind of like how that's being applied to games here. Like you could hand them out or, you know, just kind of scribble all over them and no one really cares, as opposed to like super nice special edition Blades in the Dark book I have where... Yeah, I get like one corner ding and I'm really mad about it.
Right. Yeah, that's true. It's not as precious and more shareable. That's cool.
How about you?
Well, for me, so at the end of The Other Side Minis, and I started doing color tests for the Hate board game.
I saw that,
minis.
Right.
Yes.
The one where everyone's a cannibal.
Yes, right. And it's a big difference in quality going from war game minis to board game minis.
Really?
Yeah, I really forget that.
Even though you're talking kind of like a negative one.
Yeah, in a negative way, because there's a lot more cleanup work that you're doing. And even though The Other Side was pre-built, they're pre-constructed miniatures, they were very clean. They came out, there was very minimum to do. And I'm noticing that with board games, even though these are gorgeous miniatures, there's a lot more cleanup and you lose a lot more detail.
Right.
There's things definitely that are supposed to be necklaces and chains and things that just aren't coming through. And once you've primed and you've done a layer on top of that, you're really suffering. So you've got to go extra thin with board game miniatures. But is that really worth it? Because you're doing over 100. Usually. Hate's nice because it's a kind of war band skirmish level. So you're not doing quite as many as some other board games, but there are heroes and larger ones that are going to take, you know, days of work. And they may never even get put on the board. You know,
it depends on
like what's drawn during a session or what comes up, what campaign you're playing. So that's the frustration of board game minis, is you don't get the use out of them and you put a lot of care in painting them. So what I'm trying to do is come up with kind of a speed paint style where at least I want to get color differences. So on the board, there's big differentiation between, you know, the different tribes and different characters, but it's not as important that they look gorgeous, you know, up close. And really a lot of the detail on the plastic itself isn't going to be worth that. I've seen some really nice stuff people have posted on Instagram of painting those minis, but I can't imagine the time that it took.
And
it just doesn't seem worth it for how much we're going to
I'm guessing that the Instagram image is just a single mini.
Yes, of course.
What they're not showing is all the 30 left, the other ones that aren't painted.
But. Yeah, that's true. They pick a couple of really gorgeous ones and just, go to town and you get beautiful textures and nice contrasts and just...
A couple years ago, I picked up the Fantasy Flight Games, Descent first edition, secondhand, and it came with a bunch of expansions. And I was planning on painting those minis too, and I kind of, looking at them, would have run into the same problem about some of the detail is lost and the plastic is kind of soft. But in terms of differentiating colors and stuff, I was just planning on leaving the base's whatever color of plastic it was.
Oh, right.
So, you know, you kind of have like, okay, this blue one over here is whatever. And even if they were kind of painted the same, that base would differentiate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. With Dungeon Saga, so the Mantic kind of dungeon crawl board game, the detail in the miniatures wasn't great, and a lot of them were pretty low quality. And so I just kind of clear-coated everything, because they're broken up by faction by plastic color. Okay. So like the abyssals are red and the orcs are green, and just clear-coated them and then did a wash and then dry brush.
Right, okay.
And it at least gives it some, it raises enough of the detail and gives it enough so it looks more like a finished piece. Mm-hmm. And it works as a board game piece, but not something you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you're not going to win the Golden Demon. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's nice because it looked almost like more carved out of some other material. Nice. And as soon as you clear coat them, you lose that shiny plastic look. So they feel more precious and more interesting and look nice on the board and much more photographable. They're much nicer to photograph.
I've not had a chance to paint anything recently. And by recently, I mean like 5 years. But I do want to try, I don't know what the technique is called, but you base everything black and then you use white as to kind of like spray down on the miniature from a, you know, either directly above or at an angle to simulate the light hitting it and then kind of use that as the base to work up from.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think that's a nice technique, kind of speeds things up because then you can do thin kind of glazing layers and you don't have to do as much of the, pay attention to the angle of the light and things, because I think that's the interesting thing about miniature painting is what you're doing is you're trying on a miniature scale to recreate how light is hitting this, because how real light hits it ruins, you know it's small.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
You're trying to cheat the, it's like an optical illusion of what this is supposed to look like.
Yeah, the ultimate painting thing, in my opinion, was non-metallic metals and object source lighting.
Yes.
Where light is supposedly being cast from an object the miniature is holding.
Yes.
And I've seen some fantastic examples of that.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I go,
yeah.
I have no idea how you did that.
Yeah, yeah. That's some nice stuff. And amateurs trying that, it just looked crazy sometimes.
you got to start from somewhere. Yeah. I mean,
but and that's where people want to be, and they don't realize, you got to kind of work up. You got to get your layers nice and thin and your brushes nice.
As someone who went through elementary school as part of the mentally gifted program, one thing that instilled in me is if I'm not good at it immediately, quit. So yeah, the object source lighting, non-metallic metals, even drawing, which I used to be able to do. I'm like, I do something, I'm like, it looks like crap, so I'm just going to stop.
Nice.
For certain values of nice, yeah.
So are you an SNL fan?
Not particularly.
No, yeah.
Only because it's difficult to watch over here.
Yeah, that's true. It's blocked. It's region blocked on YouTube and everything. Yeah. Yeah, so SNL had a sketch.
I did see that.
Oh, you did? Yeah, yeah. I finally got some on somebody's Twitter. It wasn't blocked on somebody's Twitter. Yeah, I got to see. And not a very good sketch.
It was not funny.
No, there wasn't anything really funny about it. But it inspired something on Twitter that I was pretty surprised by.
Yeah, I didn't realize that is what had inspired the D&D selfie hashtag. Mm-hmm. You know, us kind of being here, we're like 12 hours ahead of most of the people I follow. So we see stuff. If it comes from the other side of the States, we're like 12 hours behind.
Mm-hmm.
And just saw all these people posting D&D selfies and all this stuff and didn't realize it came from that SNL skit. Then finally saw, again, on Twitter, exactly like you, someone had embedded the video, watched it and didn't laugh once because it wasn't funny. And almost like as soon as it started, I'm like, I know exactly what this is going to be.
Yes.
And then, the actors jump up and essentially LARP all the stuff. And I'm like, this is still what a segment of the population thinks the games are like. So I joined in on that hashtag, and even though I don't really play D&D and there's other games I'd prefer over it, as I just kind of said, why not? It's the game that got me into it. And SNL, and I guess not necessarily them, because I wasn't mad at SNL, I'm just like, it's lazy, it's not funny, it's
right,
could have done something else. But seeing a lot of people just posting on that and to show the diversity of people who actually do play Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing games.
Yeah, I thought it was nice. I mean, it definitely, people's reaction to it is a sign that, you know, this is a legitimate hobby. This isn't something that only basement dwellers play. This is a legitimate social activity that people are playing at bars and universities in more public places.
And you want to be real public. I mean, they're filling, the critical role is filling theaters.
Yes. And so I think a lot of people were a little bit offended that their hobby isn't as being taken as seriously when there's a lot more money. I mean, it's Hasbro funded. So, it's a big product. So it's just, that's very funny though, because I think Dungeons and Dragons jokes were pretty much safe territory for the past, in the previous like 30 years, you could easily make fun of those geeks, but now there's a little bit more legitimacy, and especially online, people are a little bit more offended.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I wasn't offended; it just kind of wasn't funny. But like, there were so many other jokes you could have done to make fun of gamers or people who play Dungeons and Dragons to use that stereotype. Just like it's just kind of lazy.
Yeah, lazy. That's what I was just gonna say. Yeah, and I've actually seen Kit Harington has actually done funny comedy, and I don't know if it was on SNL, but there was a silly sketch that he was in where he was just playing Jon Snow. He was in the costume. costume, doing the accent. And it was like having like a gloomy goth kid at the table. I think it was like Thanksgiving or something. And Jon Snow is there. And so they just pan down the table and he's just brooding and talking about winter coming. And people are like, lighten up, man. Like, so that weird, you know, acting out of, you know, in a weird context, it was very funny. And he did it really well because he was playing his character.
Right.
But this, yeah, I just don't think it was worth it. Oh, you're on a show where you have a sword, so let's make fun of a game that you have swords.
Yeah, it's just like
it was a weird stretch.
It seemed like it was written by someone who didn't know anything about the hobby,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of weird now since
I
guess so many people have at least tried it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's true. Future podcast topics. There was something that had also come up on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Which is where I pretty much live now that Google Plus is dead.
And I think you got into it with a few people about this.
Yep.
I think this was an interesting. So what was this topic that was frustrating for you and that people argued with you?
GM dice fudging.
Mm.
In other words, you know, the GM in some games rolls behind the screen or their dice rolls are hidden and either ignoring a die roll or, you know, changing the number to get an outcome that they think is better. I'm going to do a future topic on it, but my stance is don't do it.
Right. Well, what's your biggest reason? Like, what's your biggest frustration with that?
I think it's not frustration. The way I see a die roll, especially from the GM side, is there are very often a whole bunch of steps prior to the die roll where the GM takes the narrative situation into account about like what the character is do, what the NPC is doing, what's going on, mm-hmm. any kind of modifiers or whatever that would either change or alter the situation. And the GM can always say yes or roll the dice.
Mm.
Like if you think something should just happen, just make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Going to the die or making a die roll for me indicates that you are okay with a randomizer determining what happens or you're not sure.
Yes, yes.
And to then roll the dice or to then reach that point, roll the dice, see what it says, and then decide to go with something else, I feel you really could have made that decision prior to rolling the die.
Mm-hmm.
The one time I would be okay with fudging dice rolls is almost when you do a complete do-over where you're not that familiar with the game. And my argument does assume that everyone is familiar with the mechanics,
mm-hmm.
where you go, whoa, okay, I was honestly not expecting that outcome. And it's going to ruin the fun for the game. So let's just rewind and pretend that die roll didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally fine with that. And people have pointed out that if you're okay with sort of saying yes prior to rolling the die, what's the difference with saying yes after rolling the die?
Mm-hmm.
And the big answer is there isn't one. But I kind of feel like if you've gone through all these steps and you've decided that I need or I'm going to roll a die to resolve whatever happens, why then choose to ignore that?
Yeah.
Like, okay, maybe you came up with a better answer as the dice hit the table, in which case just don't even look at it,
mm-hmm.
and just make a call. Or other people said that as GM, they roll dice just to kind of create that tension, which, okay, kind of seems a bit pointless.
Mm.
But I'm also coming from the perspective of someone who prefers to run games where the GM doesn't really roll dice, such as like Power by the Apocalypse, or you have to roll out in the center in front of everyone like Cortex Prime, where you kind of like build stuff up. So the options for die fudging kind of aren't there, mm-hmm. or aren't necessary. It also kind of feels a bit cheaty, because players aren't allowed to do that. And you would get into it with a player if they gave you incorrect dice information, so why isn't the GM kind of held to the same standard?
Mm. Look forward to that topic.
So if I'm on that one, feel free, or you're going to hear all that all over again. Yeah,
yeah, but I think that'll be interesting back and forth. And take a look at Hive Mind on Twitter, Chris's Twitter account, because there's a lot of discussion. I think there's a lot of people coming from kind of different mm-hmm. places and different experiences with role-playing that had a lot of varied opinions. So I think it'll be a good discussion. I think it's a good stuff, good thing to get out there. So
might have to throw through chairs, throw a few chairs, yeah.
And speaking of future topics.
Chair throwing? Oh.
this does include chair throwing. I'm sure there's mechanics for it. We're going to be reviewing the John Carter of Mars RPG from Modiphius soon. So
That's a 2D20 thing, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes. Okay. So we've reviewed the Conan system previous to this, and this is going to it's very similar in the mechanics, and it's just going to be a setting update and kind of, I think, a little bit of system refinement, because they keep refining that system like throughout the Star Trek adventures. And
Which was the first 2D20? Mutant Chronicles?
Probably Mutant Chronicles was the first IP that they did that with. Yeah, I'm not sure about their earliest 2D20, but this is the kind of latest refinement of it, and using that, the setting of
John Carter
Mars. Yeah, the Mars setting. So what we probably will do for the episode, like we did with Conan, is watch the Disney John Carter.
Which, you know what? I had my qualms with it as someone who likes that Sword and Planet stuff, but it wasn't terrible.
The casting was a little funky, but I mean, the effects were amazing. They did a really nice job visualizing that world.
I was not expecting this to happen, but I was rather disappointed that people didn't just wear like jeweled bikini bottoms, because that's technically what they should be in.
Yes. Yes.
But I was really not expecting to see that on screen, so I was not.
Yeah, because I backed the Kickstarter, so I got the nice
slipcover
book. And the art in there is very G rated.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's very, well, yeah. So it doesn't quite have that pulpy, savage, right. You know.
Well, I was kind of wondering, like, okay, it's tough. You do want to stay true to the source material, but you also kind of want to make sure that everyone can play this game.
That's true,
And I would be more comfortable in seeing, like, Deja Thoris, whatever, like, topless, if it was in a non-sexual pose and or if guys were also depicted the same way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and I think – and that's probably something they don't want to deal with as far as the setting is, like, oh, this has to be a mature rated because there's, you know, physical nudity.
That's, they didn't want to get yanked off Tumblr for female-presenting nipples.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's a difficult line to walk because I think you do want to have as many people enjoy the system, not just the old fans or people that are thinking about the, like, 70s, you know, art.
I can imagine, like, someone – like a parent or someone picking up, you know, that book for their kid or, like, a kid leafing through it and then like, well, you know, not having come from the original, yeah, you kind of can't do that and not label it mature, which means some people aren't going to look at it out of principle.
Yeah, and I think then if it had a mature rating, then you're going to have to probably go all out mature as far as, like, you know, make it as violent as possible, you know, like, like make the combat system extra disgusting and savage and
so, or make some of the dire results people lose clothing.
Now you get to put clothing back on with multiple successes.
That's healing, duh.
There's a Kickstarter that I'm not sure it has a little bit to go still. It's not anywhere near the last week.
Oh, I think it just opened.
Oh, yeah. So we got a good month of it. And it was actually something, before I even knew there was a Kickstarter, someone had posted the link for the pre-release rules. And this was something I really admired this company for. So the game is called Lancer. And basically, it's a giant mech, what they call a mud and lasers RPG.
So I knew about Lancer reading an article on it recently. It's been the rules have been going for a year now.
Oh, wow.
And they've always been free. Mm-hmm. And I knew about Lancer because one of the main people in it, and I'm going to get their name wrong, is the person who writes and illustrates the Kill 6 Billion Demons webcomic, which is fantastic webcomic.
Uh-huh.
And they recently got picked up by Image to do print books. And they posted about it on their blog. So I'd kind of been following it. I've actually not read the rules, but they've been free for about a year now, which is admirable. And they said the rules are always going to be free. The Kickstarter is just for the print book. And I really like that. It looks like the system borrows from Shadow of the Demon Lord a little bit, Downtime from Blades in the Dark, and a couple other things. So I was personally a little bit turned off when I saw that it was built on Shadows of the Demon Lord, because I read that and nothing in that system really grabbed me. But it was almost an auto back just for the art alone.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Right, and it's mostly, if the page is any indication, is about 20% of a 500-page rule book, which is ridiculous, is rules. The rest is mostly art and setting.
Yes, yeah.
So I'm more willing to back it because of that, because even if I don't particularly care for the rules, I can go, well, I've got all this other fluff to port to a system of my choice.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I was so happy to see that. And I think they even have a pledge level where they're like, give us a few bucks and we'll send you the link for the final PDF, because it's nice that you want to support us, but this rule set is always going to be free. And I think that's why I saw so many people posting about, we've had really good play sessions, really good campaigns with this game and the system. And then I saw that they were doing a Kickstarter for a book. I hope that they keep in mind, though, that publishing a 500-page bound book, you have to do some pretty decent quality publishing. You know, printing, the print quality has to be very decent, because it's very easy to break spines on books that thick.
Yeah, I would hope so. Yeah. But I think, I guess getting into Kickstarters in general a little bit, I've seen people say that it's unrealistic to start a Kickstarter and then try to build a community and interest in it after the fact.
Yes.
You kind of have to do that well before you launch a Kickstarter to get the amount of support. And the team, and I'm forgetting the name of the company that they formed, obviously have it mostly through the webcomic.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I read through the first few paragraphs of the setting, and the setting sounds really fun. So it's humans and it's the Milky Way, but you're still kind of referring to our solar system and Earth as the cradle. Like, that's the origin of, and still the governing body of this, the whole galaxy.
I'll be slightly skeptical if there's some kind of emperor corpse. on a golden throne right. in the cemetery.
Yeah. I think it's basically like a UN. They said that like there's like a governing, you know, group of people that's formed from the original solar system, and it's almost mythologized because no one's quite sure. No one's actually seen them, but they're, you know, they are this ruling body, and most people are born so far from that origin system. It has a mythology to it of this is where we come from. This is who decides how we live. But the reason that your mech pilots are involved, the cavalry is involved in resolving disputes and why there is combat is because everything is so far flung. And so there's civil wars and skirmishes and things that happen.
I almost kind of think you have to do stuff like that because, not have to, but one benefit of doing that is you're not locking the players and GM or play groups into what that governing body is.
Yes.
You know, you kind of, I've seen it done poorly, but if you kind of like, yeah, turn it into mythology or legend, or as you said, people are so far away from it that they're not really impacted, allows you to just say, it's whatever we want it to be at the table and makes it a bit more accessible, and you don't even have to worry about it if you don't want to. Thinking about something like Dune, where kind of the ruling body and stuff is well known, like you can get bogged down, I know I certainly can, in specifics and wanting to portray stuff accurately. So I almost often prefer a nebulous, it's maybe this, but no one really knows, because then you can just ignore it if you want to.
That's a good point, and I think they're going to do a good job with the setting, and the whole setting itself is like 5,000 years.
It's pretty far future.
So it's nice and removed and developed. And I think it seems like the flavor is really good, because they use, you know, a lot of the names of the mechs themselves are mythology, you know, are from mythology and things. So there'll be nice Earth history inspired flavor that I think will make the, you know, the setting fun.
Itself. Yeah, names are really hard to come up with, but they do make a setting feel a lot more real when you name kind of models of things.
And
people have like slang things for them. GM, I struggle with coming up with names. Like the Sprawl game, I'm just like, I don't know, it's a gun. But like, you know, actually giving it a name would actually make it seem a lot more real, and I think does a lot to improve a setting.
Yeah. Take a look at that. Yeah. So Lancer. So of course, yeah, we're not involved in any way. This is just something we're pointing at as something we liked. And they've got a free rule set. So take a look at those pre-release rules, and they're probably even linked to them on the Kickstarter.
Yep. And it's not even like a quick start or anything. I think it's like, here is the text copy of the rules that are going to be in the book, just maybe sans art.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's nice. It's a nice thing that they're doing. So the art is what attracted a lot of people to it. So they're going to do a nicely illustrated, you know, printed version of the book. So that'll be nice to see.
I'm pretty excited. Probably go read through the free rules, see what's going on.
Yeah, the system itself sounded nice, though, because they specifically say narrative play and then tactical combat. So they probably, you know, they want you to be playing on a grid. I was thinking, too, Lego. We can actually build these mechs and actually, like, do, like, kind of, like, representational, like, few, you know, just a few blocks that kind of represent on a map. But that would be really fun to kind of do some Lego mechs.
It's been a long time since I've busted out my Legos and built mechs. 3 years.
And especially when it's just a rule set, it gives you the kind of freedom to, like, you know, you can use hexes, you can use, you know, grid, you can use whatever to kind of represent what you're going to be doing in the game. So, yeah, I like that idea.
Me too, yeah.
That was some of the things that we've been thinking about and dealing with this week. So if you have any comments about anything that we discussed or any ideas for topics in the future, please feel free to let us know either in the comments under this link or on Twitter. So Idle Red Hands on Twitter. Where can people find you, Chris, if they want to argue with you about GM
If they want to argue about me, send a letter. But otherwise, I'm at Hivemind.
Okay.
Hivemynd.
Good.
On Twitter.
And anything you're currently working on or anything you've got posted that you might want people to take a look at as far as like...
Not yet. Okay. I always have stuff on, but I haven't posted anything recently.
And you can find me through the Ida Red Hands website. And also I do a weekly cartooning live stream. So at Abuse Cartoons on Twitter, abusecartoons.com is the website. So take a look at that if you want to see some single panel inanimate object humor. Thanks for joining us. This will be a weekly thing. So we will be back again with kind of more updates about what's going on in the week with Ida Red Hands.
See you later.
Bye.